Hello and welcome to Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and today I'm joined by Chris Dolman to discuss how you can avoid an AI scandal. Chris is the Executive Manager of Data and Algorithmic Ethics at the Insurance Australia Group, a Gradient Institute Fellow, and he regularly contributes to external research on responsible AI and AI ethics. In 2022, he was named the Australian Actuaries Institute's Actuary of the Year in recognition of his work around data ethics, and was also included in the Carinium Global Intelligence Business of Data list of the top 100 innovators in data and analytics. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And before we go on, you have to do a disclaimer.
I do, yes. Thank you for that. So just to let everyone know that I'm here in my personal capacity as Chris Dolman, and anything I say should be attributed to me, not necessarily an employer or anyone else you might think I'm associated with.
With that out of the way, let's get on with the episode. Elon Musk once described AI as being far more dangerous than nukes. And a recent study conducted at NYU found that 36% of AI researchers surveyed believed it plausible that decisions made by AI or machine learning systems could cause a catastrophe this century that is at least as bad as an all-out nuclear war. Now, I don't think the technology is quite at the existential threat level just yet, but it is at the point where AI can cause significant damage to the reputation of an organization if it's used incorrectly. And a lot of organizations are now starting to wake up to that fact and have become very interested in understanding AI ethics and responsible AI.
That's right. That's a wonderful trend.
The fact that you're working in a job with the title Executive Manager of Data and Algorithmic Ethics suggests that your employer is one of these organizations.
Well, that's right. And I like to think that we were one of the first in the market to make that decision. Certainly, when I started that role, it's almost 5 years ago now, I think, there were very few others that I was aware of in the market doing similar sorts of work. And there's a lot more now than when I started. So that the trend's definitely been in a positive direction. So I think others have started to recognise that this is a topic they need to take seriously.
How did you first become interested in data and AI and ethics yourself?
It was kind of an organic sort of process. So I spent part of my career as an actuary doing all the usual things that actuaries do in insurance companies, and then moved into the sort of AI data-driven decisions space probably around 2013, 14, sometime like that. And I was basically building the data science practice at IAG outside of the traditional actuarial areas, right? So insurance companies have huge, you know, pricing teams and folks building capital models and reserve models and things like that. And so that's all well established. But there's heaps of other decisions that you can apply data science to. So we spent a bit of time looking at claims decisions and things like that. And so I was basically building the team, trying to do these sort of new and different things with data and models rather than the traditional stuff. So I spent a few years building that team up and doing some useful projects for the company. And it became pretty clear to me that there needed to be someone independent from that team with a suitable level of sort of technical knowledge about how things were actually done to basically wear the sort of risk management hat, if you like. So we obviously have a risk management function who do all sorts of risk management things, but you need to have a sort of fairly specialized person to really look at the ethics issues that can arise from these systems. And you don't typically find that in your average risk manager, who's a bit more of a generalist. And there were loads of news stories around this time, sort of, you know, 2015, 2016-ish, of AI systems going wrong. And so I kept looking at that as the person managing this team, thinking, well, I need to avoid a sort of issue like that. And it'd be great if there was someone independent from the team who was, you know, challenging what I was doing. And so I basically proposed that this job should be created, and it would be really interesting if I was the one that was doing it. So that kind of was how it came about, I guess. And yeah, we've gone from there.
So you're the AI and ethics specialist for the whole of the organisation?
Basically, yeah.
I think it's very good that IAG is big enough so that it can employ a person in a role like you? Because I would imagine that a lot of organisations wouldn't be big enough to have a dedicated AI ethics expert.
Yeah, that's probably true. So you need to make sure, if you're not of that sufficient scale, maybe your data science team is like 3 people, and so you're not necessarily going to have someone purely dedicated to this particular topic, that your risk management team maybe gets suitably trained, or that you've got some external advisors that you can bring in from time to time to help you on this topic, or that the data science team gets trained properly. I mean, that should happen anyway. I think there needs to be some independence from that team to make sure that there's objectivity.
AI ethics and data ethics are now becoming a part of a lot of data science training. A lot of university lecturers are now incorporating it into their courses. So I think you'll find that there's an increasing number of data scientists who are thinking about ethics from the word go.
I think that's right. And that's obviously a very good trend. So that definitely people will have more of a skill set, which is helpful. I think you do still need to have an independent function, though, challenging what that team's doing, because that team might get an instruction from management to build a model to do a thing, and maybe that team doesn't have the political power to object to that if it's a illegitimate intent, for example. That team might have that power, or it might not, and so you need an independent function, either a risk function or an audit function, to really be asking those sorts of questions. I do think there needs to be some training or skill in second or third line to make that work properly.
I think the other problem is data scientists really want to get involved in doing a lot of these projects. And in their enthusiasm to do a particularly exciting sounding project, they'll often fail to stop and ask, is this something they should be doing?
Well, that's right. It's the sort of can we, should we dilemma, which a lot of people face. And yeah, if you're someone who will, play around with new technology, try and build things in a bit of a hacky way and just see how things work, which a lot of engineering type people are like that just naturally, then it's quite easy to build something that maybe if you step back for a second and thought about it, you might not want to do that. I think that natural tendency certainly is there in that type of person. It's quite hard to resist that sometimes when there's new shiny toys around that we can play with. It's something that people need to build as a skill in themselves, to learn to say no to things, even if they look exciting, if it's the wrong thing to be doing.
And learn to take that step back before they start diving in and embarking on the project.
That's right. And it's not always about saying no as well. Quite often you can pivot ideas into something that's acceptable and away from something that's not. So you don't necessarily say, we're not going to do that project at all. It's just a no-no. Sometimes you have to say that, but sometimes you can take something that might be not quite so good and turn it into something that's actually okay. So, but if you don't step back and think about that stuff, then you can go down the wrong track quite easily.
Last year, you co-authored a chapter in the book Checkmate Humanity on the de-risking of automated decisions. When you're talking about automated decision-making or AI-based decision-making, what exactly do you mean?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. It's worth saying as well that whilst that's a chapter in a book, which we can buy, and I definitely encourage them to do that, that chapter is also available as a free paper, and we'll put a link in the podcast notes to that. It's a paper authored by myself and others at Gradient Institute, so we'll definitely share that with people. So what do we mean by automated decisions? We're a little bit hand-wavy typically on this definition, and I think that's I don't think it's helpful to be too precise, because otherwise that's just a really unproductive debate, right? But whenever you're removing humans from a substantial part of the decision-making process, maybe they're still involved maybe at the end or maybe in defining the objective, so you're going to have some people involved somewhere in the process typically. But if generally you're taking data as an input and generating some output automatically, be that a prediction or a recommendation or some action to be taken, whether or not some human reviews that or not is sort of academic, then that's basically an automated system. So that could be like really, really simple business rules. Take this data from customers and generate a recommendation for a product to put on a website or something, right? So that happens plenty of time in retail today. Insurance companies do this when they set prices for policies. So you go in and you go and buy a car insurance policy and you get asked a bunch of questions. The answers for those questions will be used to work out the riskiness of you as an individual and your vehicle, and that will automatically generate a price at the end. That's your quote for insurance. And no human being was involved in that process. Obviously, humans are involved in building the system that generates prices, but that particular interaction in the moment is done totally automatically. So that's an automated system. Sometimes they're really complicated. Insurance pricing is pretty complicated. Sometimes they're really, really simple. But the risk management issues are sort of the same. Complexity doesn't really matter that much, because all the risks that can occur can still occur for simple systems as well.
And with that insurance example, I'd imagine before AI systems came about, probably what happened was there was a person in an office looking up a rate book.
That's right. And that rate book is an automated system in some sort of abstracted sense, if you like. So you take inputs, being the data that the person has given you, the person, and then you look up the numbers in that rate book and multiply them together or add them up or whatever you do. And that generates an output that you don't usually have authority in how that calculation works, right? You're just looking up numbers in tables, but computers weren't invented. And so you couldn't get a computer to do that. Now you can. So that could be automated, but humans were removed from a large part of that decision-making process anyway, traditionally. They might have discretion at the end though, right? And underwriters often do even today for certain types of insurance. So, but yes, it's an example of an automated system. And you can find, you know, insurance pricing models being proposed way, way back in the late 1600s, very, very pre-computer.
When I was a student actuary, one of our lecturers was a man in his 60s. So he'd been in the industry for a very long time. And he was telling us about how insurance calculations were performed when he was a graduate. And what it involved was having a room full of graduates doing calculations with pen and paper all day, every day. And that was a computer in those days.
That's right. Computer used to be a person. So, and then we invented automated mechanisms of doing those calculations, thankfully for us. So, yeah. So anyway, in this paper, shall I tell you a bit more about what we sort of said in that?
Oh, please do.
We basically identify some of the core issues that arise when sort of automation occurs. It's useful to think of that by using examples, because I think it really brings some color to the discussion. So maybe let's think about call centers, right? And how we manage the humans in call centers and deal with the issues that those humans can cause. And then compare that to like an automated version of a call center, which is, you know, like a website doing a similar sort of job. Like, what can go wrong in a call center? And I've never managed a call center, but I've certainly observed them and sort of thought about them a bit. I mean, you've got human beings on the phone with customers all day long making decisions. And so there's lots of different failure modes that can occur, right? You could have incompetence of those people on the phone. Maybe they're not properly trained. Maybe they're just not very good at their job. And so they're making decisions that perhaps they shouldn't be. They can be inconsistent. So maybe they're making good decisions on one day, bad decisions on another day. So they're not taking the same action with the same input, if you like. Maybe they're just having a bad day. Maybe they're tired. They didn't sleep well. Maybe they've got personal issues going on that's distracting them. All these things can make human beings make similar sort of bad decisions. Maybe the rules they've been given are unclear. So maybe the rule book that they've been given and trained on didn't describe this particular situation that they've come across. And so they've got to use their judgment. Maybe they get that wrong. And they have free will, right? So they could, if they decide, arbitrarily ignore the rules if they wanted to and just make some decision that's the wrong one according to the rules, but they can do that because they have free will. And so all these sorts of things can go wrong with human beings. So we've, over many, many, many years managing call centers, worked out controls that we put in place in all sorts of businesses to manage people in that situation, right? So there'll be rule books that are clear, that are well written, that people can understand, that they're trained on, and then you monitor people against adherence to those rules by some audit function or risk function or what have you, who might be listening into calls occasionally or checking recordings or things like that, making sure that those people are doing what they ought to be doing. You usually have some escalation or complaints mechanism, right? So if customers aren't happy, they can talk to a manager or a higher up. And so if things are going wrong, that can be used as a control. And that, like, those people problems, they just don't scale very well, right? So if I've got someone in the call center who's not doing their job properly, there's a limit to how much damage they can cause, because they can only be on the phone for, you know, 8 hours a day dealing with a certain number of customers. That's not my whole call center. So the damage can be quite limited even when damage occurs. So we can manage that according to that limitation. When we automate that, So if we take some of those interactions away from people, and now we've got some automated system doing a similar thing, like a website with some data-driven process built into it, say, chatbots, if you want to think about that, but it doesn't have to be that, could be anything really, you actually solve a lot of those problems that you had with people. A lot of those problems with people related to free will and sort of inconsistency. So computers, they don't have free will. They're going to do exactly what they're told all day, every day, until you turn them off. They're going to be completely consistent, give them the same inputs and you get the same outputs. And so you can rely on them to do what you've told them to do. The problem is they do literally exactly what they're told. And so that common sense doesn't exist. So you'll get some spectacularly silly failures, which human beings would not make, but computers will, because you haven't quite worked out how you've programmed them. And maybe there's some weird edge cases that cause some funny problems. There's loads of examples now in the literature of that. My favorite being the bald linesman example. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't.
This was a soccer game in Scotland. I forget what the team was. And they'd replaced the human camera operator with an automated camera operator that was just trained to follow the ball. And so it was just, you know, moving around following the ball. But there was a linesman with a bald head, and that looked from a distance with certain lighting too much like a ball. And so the game got missed, and it just sort of followed the linesman up and down the touchline. Like, no human's going to make that error. If you tell a human camera operator, follow the ball, they're not going to film the linesman. But the computer does it because weird errors happen that we can't comprehend. And you might not be monitoring them properly, right? If you're used to monitoring people, then you've got, you know, risk managers who are listening into calls and doing spot checks and things like that. You've got to monitor automated systems very differently. It's more like an IT sort of monitoring process. You're checking for sort of systematic failures and downtime. And it's totally different. So that's all in the way the system works, though. The design of those systems can also fall down, because traditionally, management's just writing the rule book to tell the, you know, service staff how to operate. Management aren't writing the rule book directly in most automated systems. They're declaring a goal that the automated system should have and giving that to the model builders with some data to try and train a model to achieve goal. And management typically aren't used to specifying that goal to the level of precision that you really need to. And I've heard throughout my career people say things like, my goal is to maximize sales. Well, that's never been true any time it's ever been said, unless people are literally giving things away, right? So there's always constraints in place. But quite often those constraints are sort of unsaid, right? We don't need to say don't give things away, because people just know. But the computer doesn't know. And so if you don't tell it that's part of the goal set, the constraint, it's going to give things away potentially. So you've got to be quite careful how you program these things. And maybe the AI devs or the model builders don't quite understand those implicit constraints, particularly if they're not from the industry, because some of those might be quite subtle. So you've got to be quite careful that there's that level of understanding as you instruct people down. And managers, if they've not built automated systems before, don't really know how to do that. So that's quite tricky. And then upwards, like, there's no manual at the end. So the manager can't pick up the instruction book and say, okay, I'm happy with how we're instructing those decisions to be made. You can't do that, right? You might have some explainable AI process to give them a feel for what's going on, but it's not quite the same thing. And so do they really have confidence in how those decisions are being made? Perhaps not. And so there's all sorts of different failure modes, is what I'm trying to illustrate, which didn't really exist in human systems. We've sort of solved those by automation, but we've created a whole bunch of new ones. And so we've got to really adapt the way our governance works to deal with that.
Sounds like the biggest problem with human systems is humans going rogue. And the biggest problem with AI systems is AI not going rogue.
Yeah, that might be an interesting way of thinking about it. Although maybe rogue is an interesting word to explore. I mean, it depends what we mean by rogue. When we talk about humans, in that sense, and the way you used it then, you're sort of talking about humans like almost deliberately breaking the rules, or like using their free will in a way that we wouldn't desire. So that's kind of what we mean by a rogue human. Rogue AI is sort of, so it's true that it's sort of not going rogue and that it's kind of obeying the instructions precisely, but maybe we didn't quite know what the instructions were. I think that's the problem. So it's true that it's not going rogue, but maybe it's kind of going rogue in our minds because we didn't know how we'd instructed it. That's perhaps the core of the issue. But there are other issues as well around scalability, right? So rogueness will scale very well with an automated system, whereas it doesn't with humans.
Well, unless you get a complete uprising, but that's probably not going to happen in a non-revolutionary situation.
Yeah. I mean, look, humans can, they can get together and scale in that way, but it's not very quick usually. Yeah. So then we basically take that sort of discussion, which you have at the start of this paper about how systems fail differently to humans. And we say, well, this then translates into some risks that you need to be mindful of when you're building these systems. And we sort of have three categories for that. So there's issues of legitimacy. So are you building something that's like, that should be built, that people are going to accept as like socially acceptable? Is it legal? Is it suitably transparent, if that's something that ought to exist? Those sorts of things. That's right at the start of like the development cycle. Are you building something that ought to be built? Then we talk about design issues. So if you've got something that ought to be built, did you actually design a system that achieves that goal? Or did you make some error somewhere and get that wrong? And then you have execution problems. So even if you build something, even if you have a legitimate intent, you build it correctly, you can still mess up the execution. You know, you get drift and all sorts of things that can go wrong. And if you don't detect those things, then that can cause massive failures. So we go into those in quite some depth in the paper with sort of real case studies to illustrate where these have actually caused real failure in the wild. So we're not making this stuff up. It's genuine stuff that's occurred before. And so people should be very concerned about that because it could happen to them.
I thought the case studies were one of the more interesting parts of that chapter. I'd actually like to go through one of them here, the one that I'm familiar with, which is the RoboDebt scandal.
Yeah, we can talk about RoboDebt for a bit. I actually wrote another paper a couple of years before this on AI scandals, and I used RoboDebt in that as well. So I've used it twice. It's a really, really good illustrative example of some of the things that can go wrong. It's worth noting that there's a Royal Commission going on at the moment about it, so we'll probably learn more about what actually went on in due course. So a lot of this is sort of speculation and based on what's already available in public. The thing I find most helpful about RoboDebt, I don't know about you, is that it was such a simple system. And so quite often what I find in this space is people seem to take the view that the issue is the level of complexity in these systems. And so we almost need new mechanisms and new types of risk management or laws or rules because of complexity of AI systems. And that might be true sometimes, but if we only have that attitude, then we forget about like RoboDebt, which was really, really simple. I mean, you can write down the maths on the back of a napkin. There's no complexity there at all. So if you insist that all your new, you know, regulations and laws should apply to complex AI stuff, you're going to miss things like RoboDebt. So I think it's really important to focus on the automation bit rather than the complexity bit.
For any of our listeners who are unfamiliar with RoboDebt, RoboDebt is the nickname used to describe the automated debt recovery system used by the Australian Tax Office between July 2015 and November 2019. The system used a computer algorithm to match welfare payments with averaged income data and then automatically issued debt notices where overpayments were identified. However, the use of averaged income data instead of actual income data was incorrect, leading to $1.763 billion of unlawfully claimed debt and, as you mentioned before, a Royal Commission. Does that sound right to you?
It does. With one correction, perhaps, I think you said that it was the ATO system, and my understanding is it was, not Centrelink, but whatever the body is that manages Centrelink, DHS, I think it is. ATO provided the data, but I think the system was built by another department. That's my understanding anyway, but that might be incorrect. The annualized income data came from the ATO, but I think others used it perhaps unwisely. And the way the system should have run, my understanding is it should have looked at fortnightly earnings or weekly earnings, because that's how your, I think it was fortnightly it should have been, because that's how your benefits were supposed to be paid relative to your fortnightly earnings. And obviously if you've got uneven earnings during the year, if you're like a casual worker or something, then a simple average of your annualized income is not going to be the same as using your fortnightly earnings in every fortnight and then calculating the benefits each fortnight. And so it doesn't take a genius to work out that the maths there has problems.
But the people who were building the system would have been people who themselves received their income on a fortnightly basis. they were probably unfamiliar with or had no personal experience with people who did have uneven income. So it didn't even occur to them to build those into the system.
Perhaps. I mean, I think this is where if you're writing a procedure to enact something written in regulation, you've got to be really, really careful that you get people familiar with the regulation involved to make sure that it really, really is doing the thing that it ought to be doing. So certainly I'd expect the average data scientist is not going to be familiar with the nuances of, that sort of regulation. They're just not going to have looked at it before. So in the design process, you need to have people who have deep familiarity with that. I mean, I don't know what happened in that particular situation. I'm sure we'll find out in due course. I know there's been a lot of speculation.
If you can go back in time to when RoboDebt was first developed, what would you have done differently to mitigate the risks involved?
Well, I think if we look at the three categories I sort of very quickly described before, I think you've got to focus on each of them and then work out whether there's issues there. So legitimacy, right? Is this thing a legitimate thing to do? Well, it was ultimately found to be illegal. So clearly it's illegitimate. And so someone with suitable legal training probably should have worked that out before the system was even developed at its inception. That should have been worked out. Certainly further down into the development cycle, it could also have been reviewed and that could have been worked out. At the very least, that saves a lot of development time, right? Not building something and taking the time to build something that's illegitimate is useful because you can then go and do something that is legitimate. But it also prevents a lot of harm from occurring. So, that's good. Even if we thought it was legitimate, though, so even if we think that's a legitimate goal, we should go and collect debt recovery in this way, even if we thought that were true, there's obvious design problems. I mean, the maths averaging method or the maths of the averaging method that we discussed was obviously wrong. If we thought that it was a legitimate aim to go and collect that stuff, we should have implemented that correctly and not used some proxy that had obvious issues. So there's design issues there. Even without that, though, even if you thought we've got a legitimate aim, we've designed it properly, execution also had problems here. We were sending notices out to people and that gave them, they were scared, they were worried, they didn't have an obvious avenue to go and, ask questions and complain. It dragged out for a long period of time for a lot of people. And there was genuine harm from that. So the execution was problematic for that reason, because even if it's legitimate, you shouldn't be giving people those sorts of thoughts. That's not good. And it took a long time, right, for the issues to properly get identified and accepted and rectified. There was a number of years that went by, which for such a simple issue, probably shouldn't have been the case. So there's definite issues in execution there as well. So failures in lots of categories. And yeah, an example I like to use just to illustrate how things can go wrong, even in the simplest of situations.
My understanding was that the government was receiving complaints about the system within the first 6 months of it being implemented. And it reminds me of when I was teaching a number of years back, I used to have this rule for my class. If one person asks me about something I've taught, then it might just be that they can't understand it for some reason. But if three or more people are asking me the same question, then I've done something wrong. I think if the government had have had some rule like that, if one or two people are complaining, it's them. But once the volume of complaints gets above a certain number, there's probably some issue with the system. You should look into it. Then that might have helped mitigate the situation.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And that's it's a useful rule of thumb. I've used similar things myself in the past when looking at things like complaints data. So yeah, there's always people who are going to complain, and then there's a lot more people who will have a similar issue but aren't saying anything for whatever reason. And so when you do hear from the few loud voices, you need to take them seriously, not because of them, but because they might be representative of a whole bunch of other people who are staying quiet. When we've built systems, and when I've been involved in that, we're always looking at complaints data. And we talk about that in our We did a case study of car insurance total losses and how we used an AI system to improve the customer service process there. And we were really watchful and mindful for complaints from that particularly when we first launched it, when we sort of thought this is probably going to work well, but you can't be 100% confident until something's in the wild. And so we monitored that quite carefully. And thankfully, there was nothing material that came out of that. But one serious complaint would have caused a lot of review to happen.
And even the minor complaints, they can be, I'm not going to say red flags, but amber lights to what you could improve in a later version of the model.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it might not be something that requires, you know, turning it off and total rectification, but maybe it's an improvement that can be made. So useful information at the least.
Probably the biggest thing that's come out of the AI space in recent times has been ChatGPT. And I don't think I've recorded an episode lately where we haven't mentioned ChatGPT. Do you think the use of new cutting-edge AI algorithms amplifies these risks that you've just described?
It can do. I think the risks are usually the same. And so the sort of categories that I've broadly outlined are fairly similar no matter what you're doing. But you can get amplification from, I think, a few different ways, but certainly the level of excitement can often push people to do things without careful thought. And so whenever I see extreme excitement, I'm almost like the boring person at the party, right? So it's like there's extreme excitement there, but what are we really going to do? And have we thought about it carefully? We need to be pretty careful about that stuff. So the majority of people are getting really, really excited by ChatGPT. But some of it's been interesting, right? You've seen it's almost like a sport at the moment, trying to break it in lots of new ways. It's like content police whack-a-mole, right? So someone comes up with a way of breaking it. 2 days later, it gets patched. And so you can't replicate that anymore. Someone else finds a new way to get around that. What that tells you is just it's in a fairly unstable state at the moment, right? And so if you're thinking of using something like ChatGPT in a serious way, like you can use it for entertainment and that sort of, there's no problem there. If you're using it in a serious way to make serious decisions, you've got to be quite aware of some of the failures that have already occurred and the likelihood of future failures that we don't even know about yet because no one's discovered them. These things are quite vulnerable to sort of adversarial attack, aren't they, as we've seen?
I'm just waiting for the first lawsuit against ChatGPT.
Oh, you and me both. And these things, it might not be against ChatGPT. It might be against some application that uses ChatGPT in some part of a system, right? Might be how it comes about. But it's going to be pretty interesting to see how it all unfolds. I mean, these things have already been criticized for, what's the word? It's sort of IP infringement, right? So, you know, dredging information from the internet for, you know, photos that obviously are attached to particular creators or, you know, books that have been written by particular people and might be under IP restrictions, and then using that in a model that then generates creative content. I know that IP lawyers have been having lots of debates about how to deal with that sort of problem. I think we need to work out what we want first, like how do we even contemplate IP in these sorts of situations and what do we actually want? And then does the current IP law sort of work in the way that we would like? And if not, let's reform it. I think that's how we need to sort of think through this problem. Often people are going to, what do the rules say today? And that's understandable. I think we probably need to take a step back and ask ourselves, like, what do we really want? And I think that's hard, but we're probably going to have to do that at some point.
What I think is really interesting, and this is in the context of AI-generated images, is that the two major stock photo websites, Getty Images and Shutterstock, are both taking very different approaches to AI-generated image algorithms like Stable Diffusion. Getty Images is, my understanding is that they've got a lawsuit against the company that built Stable Diffusion for breach of copyright, whereas Shutterstock have come out with their own AI-generated image tool based on the images that they have in their library, and they're paying the content creators for the use of those images.
Yeah, it's been super interesting just to see the different responses. I mean, I saw, I forget which one it was, and someone had written a paper where they'd reconstituted one of those images from the training set, including the watermark and everything.
Oh, wow.
So it was obviously intended to show that particular image had been part of the training set.
It was quite a stunning piece of work. Obviously, it was a little bit grainy, but you could tell that it said it was Shutterstock or the other one. I forget which one it was. But that was only the other day. So this space is rapidly evolving, and I have no insightful prediction for where it'll end up, really, but it's very interesting to watch.
And with ChatGPT, that's built on GPT-3, and I believe that's also what Microsoft GitHub Copilot's built on, and there's the lawsuit that's out against that.
Yeah, and there's other issues with that as well, right? So some friends of mine put an article in the Australian Financial Review earlier this week just on some of the exploitative labour practices that were used in construction of ChatGPT. So it's like low-paid workers in Africa somewhere, I forget the country, looking at fairly horrible content and trying to work out how to moderate it, sort of to generate the moderation rules and what have you. And with very little help for those people who are often traumatized when they've seen horrible things as part of their day job for days on end. So it's a job we need to take. I mean, the job perhaps needs to be done somewhere, but we need to look after people who are doing it because it's a traumatizing thing. And outsourcing it to low-paid people overseas is perhaps not a good idea.
It's a difficult one because... And I don't think it should be outsourced to low-paid people overseas. But the question I have is, who should be doing that work? Because I can't think of anyone on the planet who I would wish that job on.
No, and I think it's a very tricky one. At the very least, though, you need to give people proper support, don't you? If someone's chosen to do that job, even in full knowledge that it might traumatise them and they go, yeah, okay, that's something I'm comfortable with, I'll go ahead and do it anyway. You still need to give them support if they end up getting traumatized by it and they need like psychological help or whatever. So, I mean, you get this today in lots of content moderation areas. So folks that have looked at YouTube videos for years have got similar sorts of issues. It's a tough problem because it's perhaps a job that we need some people somewhere to be doing, but we need to look after those people, don't we?
The problem is that even if you say we're not just going to put this in a area where people are low income people, will let people choose whether they do it. The people who are going to volunteer for that sort of work are going to be the people who have no choice but to do that sort of work.
That's right. And choice is, it's not never full choice, is it? So it's pretty tricky. But I guess as society, we need to be comfortable about whatever approach is being done. And leaving it up to the free market might not be the best way.
I wish I had a solution to that one, but I can't think of anything offhand.
Yeah, no, I certainly don't. But I think at the very least, we should, as society, demand that people get looked after properly. And people smarter than me should be trying to think of a proper solution to that problem. I certainly don't have any great ideas.
So what strategies could data scientists or the organisations that employ them use to identify and avoid potential AI scandals before they occur?
We talked about this a lot in the paper we mentioned earlier. So again, we like categories of three. So we have categories of three again here. So people and culture being one category, routines and processes being the other category, and technical practices and tools being the final one. And I think the most important one of the three is people and culture. Making sure that the people designing and authorizing systems have the right incentives in place, so they're incentivized to put something in market that might harm people, the right training in place, so they understand the sorts of failures that can occur and they're aware of that, and they're responsible for preventing those sorts of failure modes. It's quite important to align those sorts of interests. I'm a big fan of broad sort of co-design. So not dreaming up a system in your own four walls and then assuming it's going to be great and going and launching it on the population, but actually involving the people affected with the design of that system. And that can be done in a whole bunch of ways. But at the very least, a sort of slow, staggered launch process where you're almost like a medical trial, right? Slowly launch things out and see if they're working or going horribly wrong. And if it seems to be working okay, broaden the audience slightly and then test it again and slowly increase it. That's at the very least something that should be done, particularly when you're making an important decision. But you can also bring it into the design process as well. And there's lots of published mechanisms for doing that. So sisters and juries and things like that have been talked about overseas, which is one approach. And just having diversity in the people building the tools, I think is a good mindset to have, but it's useful to recognize that most data science teams are like half a dozen people. So you're just not going to have diversity in half a dozen people because that's just not possible. That's not enough people to have proper diversity. So you need to make sure that those people are properly trained on issues of diversity so that their minds are suitably broadened so they can think about some of the errors or issues that might occur to people who don't look like them. And so there's role-taking type approaches that you can apply to help build people's skills in the area, which we encourage. So people and culture is probably the most important category. Having routines is really useful though. So just, checklists, processes to make sure that the things that you've worked out with your sort of slow brain need to happen actually happen when push comes to shove and you've got to make decisions quickly. If you've got a procurement team that are buying software tools with embedded AI products in them, what are the questions they need to ask when they're buying those tools? Well, giving a list of things to your procurement team to make sure that that list always gets asked every time is the approach to take, rather than rolling someone in at a certain point in time to ask the things that are top of mind at that point. So making sure that checklist exists. If you've got a development process, again, what are the things that you ought to be asking at each stage of the development process? And so, like, we have these things internally now that I've helped to build. So people have a set of kind of awkward questions to answer, which is helpful because otherwise you've got to sort of think of that every time. So it helps you not miss things. The other thing is to try and avoid really, really long, horrible, drawn out complaints processes. So if you've got a system where mistakes are going to happen, because it's just inevitable, things are going to go wrong at some point. And that's true of most systems, right? Nothing's infallible. You need to have a way of dealing with the really silly errors that everyone will accept when some human looks at it, that it was a silly error. Just dealing with that quickly and moving on, rather than dragging people through a horrible, long-winded complaints process. So we talk about, we came up with a term for this. We called it preemptive contestability, which I was quite proud of. So that's before you, because contestability often gets talked about as a concept in these topics, right? But you don't want to get to contestability, which is like an adversarial sort of situation quite often if you're going to an arbitrator or whatever. You want to do something before that to deal with all the silly errors that are going to happen. So there's a wonderful example of this in the paper that we use, which is my current favorite example of AI failure because it's just stunning. This is a parking ticket in the UK. Based on image recognition. I don't know if you have you seen this one? You might not have.
No, I haven't.
This was a parking ticket, a driving offence ticket issued to someone for driving in a bus lane. And so they received this letter in the mail saying, you were driving in a bus lane. Here's the evidence of you doing that. And so they open the letter, have a look at the evidence, and it's photos of a street with a bus lane. There are no cars in the picture at all. There is a picture of a woman with a T-shirt with a word on the middle of her T-shirt says knitter. It looks a little bit like a number plate, but not that much, but enough to fool this automated system into thinking that that was a number plate. And knitter wasn't the person's number plate, but it was close enough to those letters that tricked the system. And so it obviously gone, that's this person's number plate. They were driving in this bus lane, not a woman walking in the bus lane. And so this fine got issued. And that sort of failure is going to happen with purely automated systems based on images. Things are going to go wrong that are just totally daft. But the response was really good, right? So the person who got the fine frowned a bit, I presume, laughed a bit, I presume, called the number that they could call and said, hey, have a look at this. It doesn't look great. Clearly there's been some mistake. And the person on the phone just obviously went, oh, yeah, that's a bit silly. Had a bit of a laugh about it, moved on. You need to have those sorts of quick and easy processes to deal with the just silly failures that are never going to stand up in any sort of proper adversarial process. So you don't want to just have contestability. You want to make it a bit preemptive and just cut off all the regular silly errors if you think they're likely. So I quite like that example at the moment. It's a good one, I think, just to illustrate what can occur. The last category we talk about here is sort of technical practices and tools. So this is stuff for the people building systems or the people managing them to make sure they know what's going on. So things like dashboards, control panels, proper monitoring, stuff like that. Proper technical documentation so that, everyone gets hit by a bus, there's still documentation there, so you know how your system works. It's just this classic risk management stuff that risk managers sort of know, but often people building AI systems don't know because they're not risk managers by training. So we need to have the sort of classical risk management concepts translated into data science practice. Lots of things to be done there. So we make, as I say, a whole bunch of recommendations in the paper. We, again, use case studies and examples to try and link that back to the failure modes that we talked about earlier. And so, yeah, lots of things that people can be doing, like right now, to avoid issues occurring. Because there's lots of regulation coming in this space, right? Maybe we'll talk about that next. But we don't have to wait for regulation to come along to tell us what to do. There's a whole bunch of things we could do right now to de-risk our systems. We should probably be doing those things before we're told to.
What do you reckon the regulation will look like when it comes in?
It's been interesting to watch what's happened in Europe, right? So I've said in other places, and I'll say again today, I really don't like the EU's approach to regulation in this space. I think it's got a number of flaws. I think the first thing we have to do is to just apply the laws we already have and the regulations we already have. And in many situations, there's enough there already to be getting on with, right? Most sort of high stakes decisions in society already have regulation. It already exists. We just need to use it. So if you're doing AI in financial services, that's going to be captured by the very broad definitions in financial services law and regulation that already exist. It's not the case that there's nothing there. AI is just totally unregulated and it needs new rules. You need to take the rules that already exist and apply them. That's hard, though, because we need to translate those rules into precise terms to make them implementable and to help people understand whether they're complying with them or not. And often we've not done that because a lot of these rules were written like pre-computer almost, certainly pre-lots of automation. And so we perhaps haven't worked out exactly how these things ought to apply in an automated system. And so myself, with the Actuaries Institute and the Human Rights Commission, tried to make a stab at this for human rights and discrimination rules for insurance pricing and underwriting recently. So we sort of said, that's a topic where we know there's uncertainty. Let's try and write some guidance to help practitioners understand exactly what the rules mean in the context, in the very narrow context of insurance pricing and underwriting, which, you know, is one particular example of a decision, quite an important decision, but only one example. And so that sort of translation that we've tried to do there of here's the, you know, rules written in words, here's how that applies in your mathematical system. It needs to occur more broadly, I think. So that's a big job to be done. But it must be done because we already have all these rules. They already exist. And so what the EU is doing is doing a separate set of rules for AI systems defined somehow, and the definition keeps changing. So by the time we publish this podcast, it's probably changed again. But whatever the definition is, there's going to be things that aren't captured by it. So that's not good. You want to make sure that you're capturing everything as best you can. It also competes with that sector regulation that I spoke about. So you've got existing rules in place and then this new AI rule set. So which one applies? Probably both. And so how does that work? Maybe you've got a competition in the rules. That's not ideal. Most problematic creates a bit of a two-tier approach with human systems. So if I've got like Gary the bank manager issuing loans and it's just Gary's decision what to do, that's the really old school, right? 1800s type stuff, but you know, that's how human decisions have been made for a long, long time. There's rules that apply to Gary's decisions, right? He's got to care about fair lending laws, however they look in the country he's in. He's got to care about fairness if that's embedded in the law set in the country he's in. You don't want to have Gary's decision being governed by a different set of rules to an automated Gary. And maybe the decision, if it's the same decision being illegal in one sense and not in another, that would just be a disaster. But that's unfortunately what you're going to get if you have these competing rule systems based on either AI being in scope or not for particular decisions. So it's a really, I think, not ideal way to regulate. You want to be technology neutral and say, here's an important decision. Here's some regulation that applies. However that decision's made, make it with Gary the bank manager, make it with some fancy AI system, don't care. You've got to apply these rules. And this is how they work in those different contexts. That's what I think we need to do. Obviously, the EU is not going that way, but maybe other countries will. I think the UK is being a lot more circumspect on what they're going to do. And Australia is sort of sitting and watching, I think, and trying to work things out. So we'll have to see what happens here. But it's going to be an interesting space for the next few years to see how it all evolves.
Is there anything on your radar in the AI data and analytics space that you think is going to become important in the next 3 to 5 years?
The most important thing, I think, is going to be almost what I said 5 minutes ago. It's the translation of existing rules into practice. You know, if you've got rules that say you need to treat customers fairly, well, what does that actually mean in practice when you're building an AI system? There's an almost entire academic discipline now on fairness definitions in AI systems. So we need to make some choices about how to actually implement these rules in practice. And I reckon that's going to probably come to a head over the next few years as we realize we've got the rules we need. We just need to work out what they say. And maybe we'll realize that we didn't actually know quite what we wanted when we wrote those rules. It was just sort of nice, broad sounding terms, and it'll, you know, avoid horrible things on the edges. But in the middle, when we've got to be a bit more precise, what does it actually mean? Well, we've got to work that out. So I think that's going to be a big topic over the next few years.
And what final advice would you give to data scientists looking to create business value from data?
Shiny new toys are very exciting, but very distracting. And so both in yourself and in your business, try and work out how to focus on value creation, not on shiny new toys. And if your business executives are seeing, you know, ChatGPT or DALL-E or whatever else and getting really excited about it, that's fine. But work out how to take that excitement and generate a productive discussion out of it. So don't just focus on shininess, but try and focus on value. And value might be just doing really, really simple things well. I'm a big advocate for what I call boring AI. So if it's a model that was invented 50 years ago, if it's valuable, it doesn't matter. Go ahead, build it, implement it, move on to the next valuable thing.
This sounds well aligned with Andrew Eng's concept of data-centric AI versus model-centric AI. Don't just focus on getting the flashiest model. Focus on getting your data good and using a simpler model.
That's right. I mean, we did this in our, I didn't talk about it much in this session, but never mind. I spoke about it before, our sort of motor total loss thing that we built a few years ago. And we tried some natural language processing in that. And we tried sort of the modern techniques. It wasn't GPT. I don't think that was out at that point. But we used some other things that had been invented more recently. Couldn't get it to work in a reasonable amount of time. Didn't really give any lift to what we were trying to do. And so just fell back on, you know, counting words and doing averages and that sort of thing. So you can read about that in that report, but it's really, really simple stuff, but it still works. And so if we'd had an exec that said, you know, you've got to do the shiniest new thing, that's got to be part of the system, well, we might still be here today trying to get it to work, whereas we've had 2 years of value instead because we were prepared to do something basic and get it into market.
Yeah, get a minimum viable product out first and then improve it as you go along.
That's right. A minimum viable product can be, you know, simple linear model with nothing complex. Just get it, you know.
So for listeners who want to learn more about you or get in contact, what can they do?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn, so you can get in contact with me that way. That's probably the best way. There's also links on my profile to a whole bunch of papers and things I've written. So if you're interested in those, you can find them there and you can get in touch with me that way. It's probably easiest.
Thank you for joining me today.
No, thank you very much. It's been great.
And for those in the audience, thank you for listening. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and this has been Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting.